I moseyed on down to Mobile, Alabama, and headed east on I-10. Just before crossing the bridge over Mobile Bay, I saw a sign advertising the USS Alabama. My dad had shipped out to the South Seas on a tug similar to this one during World War II. I was curious to see what it was like. The ship consisted of 9 enormous rotating cannons, with smaller anti-aircraft guns stationed at various levels of the deck. Beneath the guns was a floating armored city. The ship was an odd combination of crudely fashioned iron, laced with an endless array of complex operating systems. Extremely complex, considering the technology was over 50 years old. Of course, today you could probably replace a room full of those electronics with a laptop computer. I couldn't help but notice how often I saw familiar trademarks such as General Electric, Westinghouse, Bendix, Rockwell, and many other mega corporations. I guess there was two ways of looking at this. A, the big guys helped defend our shores, or B, the war business was a hell of a good business to be in. The big band sounds of Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman echoed haunting melodies over the PA system. That gave me an eerie feeling as I descended into the bowels of the massive war machine, much the same as my father had done 50 years ago. The difference was that he was on a tour of duty, and I was merely on a tour. I tried out one of the bunks and felt claustrophobic. My 6'4", 240-pound frame didn't fit very well. No wonder the Navy recruited kids. I found the radio room, which is where my dad would have been stationed. He never talked much about the war, but years after my dad died, I visited my uncle in California, and he told me about the day my dad's ship was attacked. They were under heavy fire from the Japanese, and the radio room took a direct hit. Uncle Richard said that my dad cried like a baby when he talked about how his best friend's blood drained around his feet for hours before someone could move the body. Dad had gone into the service to defend his country and to put some distance between himself and an iron-fisted father. I closed my eyes and breathed in the dank smell of rusty steel and tried to imagine emotions that a young Colorado cowboy would have felt. That made the inconveniences of my life seem trivial. I left the ship and drove east into Florida. It was getting dark, so I found a place on Pensacola Bay to park for the night. I woke up the next morning, disarmed my bungee cord security system, and rolled up the rear door and admired the shimmering water of the bay. One thing I've always enjoyed about life on the road was to pull up somewhere in the dark, then wake up the next morning and investigate my new surroundings. It was cool and humid, and my clothes clung to my oily skin. I was craving a hot cup of coffee and even a hotter shower. I drove down the coast and kept an eye out for some food and fuel. I was hoping to find one of those mom-and-pop truck stops of yesteryear, but I'm afraid that most of the mamas and the papas have long since retired. I did find the next best thing, Waffle House. Can't recall eating many waffles at Waffle Houses, but I've eaten a truckload of grits. I like them covered and chunked, which means covered with cheese and chocked full of chunks of country ham. Sometimes I have them smothered, covered, and chunked, which means adding a layer of chili to the mix. And I always get 2 eggs over easy to put on top with a side of order of raisin toast. It looks pretty dang disgusting when it's all stirred together, but there ain't nothing better to warm a country boy's tummy on a sultry southern morning. A Navy pilot with a flat-top haircut was sitting next to me at the counter. He looked like Val Kilmer in the movie Top Gun, the Iceman. When I was a kid, we called them butch haircuts or crew cuts, and we put a pound of butch wax in our hair to make it stand up. I had one of these haircuts until I was about 12 years old. Then the Beatles invaded the U.S. and everything began to change. I asked the flyboy where he got his haircut, and he gave me a crusty look. He thought I was making fun of him, but I convinced him that I wanted one myself. I walked in the barber shop and was slightly disillusioned. For some reason, I was expecting Floyd the Barber from the Andy Griffith Show. The barber should have been wearing a white smock with hands that smelled like witch hazel, but here was a petite young lady that smelled like foo-foo shampoo. I wasn't really that disappointed, although my sense of nostalgia had faded. My wallet suffered the most because a lousy crew cut cost $15. They were only $1.50 when I was a kid. I was further disillusioned when I looked in the mirror. The Val Kilmer Iceman thing wasn't working for me at all. I looked more like Drew Carey, but it felt good just to air out my head. I unloaded the scooter and cruised down the coast until I found a public beach. I peeled off my boots and t-shirt and went for a stroll along the water. I had a fresh pair of white sidewalls on my head that matched the spare tire mounted just above my Wranglers. It was early in the season, and the Gulf water that rushed up the beach was still cold, so I didn't get in any further than my big toe. I noticed a few bathing beauties braving the cool morning air, but they didn't seem to notice me. It occurred to me that those subliminal tapes on how to make yourself irresistible to women were not working. Oh, well, I guess they were waiting on the Iceman, not the Fat Man. I took a quick shower under a spigot next to a picnic table and dried off of my t-shirt. I had a fresh haircut, a bath, and a full belly, and life was good. I loaded up the scooter and cruised south in Zelda. I passed through several quaint little villages with quaint little cottages hidden in the shadow of not-so-quaint high-rise condominiums. Maybe my physique had changed a little for the worse over the years, but the coast had followed suit. It took most of the day to work my way from Pensacola to Panama City, which is less than 100 miles. I was getting tired of the snowbirds, tourists, and bumper-to-bumper traffic, so I decided to ditch the coastal roads and skipped over to Highway 98. By doing this, I missed a lot of neat little places with cool names like Sop Choppy and Mexico Beach. But I'd seen all the blue hairs I could handle. I'd killed a whole day picking my way along the coast, and the sun was hanging low, so I found a place to park underneath a huge live oak tree. I armed my bungee cord security system and was sound asleep in minutes. Over the years on the road, I've slept in some pretty spooky places, like the Water Market in downtown Chicago or the Watts District of East L.A. But after a while, you just get used to it and learn to sleep with one eye open and your ears tuned for anything unusual. I dozed off to sleep, and the next thing I knew, I was packed into a bunk on a battleship. I heard a loud thud, then a furious scraping sound on the top deck of the ship. The ship had turned black, then morphed itself into Zelda the Battleship. Zelda the Battleship was under attack, and I didn't have any doors or windows, but I did have a periscope. I squinted my eyes and peered into the lens and found myself looking straight into the eyes of the Iceman. He was buzzing around overhead in an F-14 fighter jet and shooting at me with grits in his guns. He was yelling something about wanting his flat-top haircut back. I was pounding on the walls trying to get outside to defend myself when I woke up and looked around. All I could see was a shadowy image on Zelda's translucent roof. It was just a squirrel. The best I could tell, it didn't have a flat-top haircut and wasn't flying an F-14. I jumped up, slapped the roof, and the squirrel was gone. The morning sun was beaming down on Zelda, and she was warming up fast. I had been asleep for 10 hours, which is unusual for me. I rolled up the door and surveyed my surroundings. There were huge live oak trees heavily laden with Spanish moss that hung clear to the ground. Squirrels were racing about, busying themselves with whatever squirrels do when they aren't attacking old trucks. I looked across the highway, and there was a small cafe, the Swanee Bell or something like that. There was a folding signboard out front advertising grits and eggs, toast and jelly, bacon or sausage, coffee included, $3.05. This was the Florida I remembered, and one I could afford. An hour later, I walked out of the Swanee Bell with a full belly and a greasy smile. It was going to be another good day. I was drifting south under a sizzling sky when I saw the turnoff to Cedar Key. I peeled off on Highway 24 without even thinking. When I was a kid, we used to come here in our old family motorhome. Things I remember the most about that camper was that it rattled to beat hell and only got 4 miles a gallon. And on hot days like this, we had to put clothespins on the fuel line to absorb the heat so the engine wouldn't vapor lock. There wasn't much chance that Zelda would vapor lock, but she didn't have an air conditioner and or windows in the back, and she was warming up like a Dutch oven. Therefore, there was a possibility that the driver might vapor lock. Cedar Key is a couple of rustic islands covered in sawgrass and palmetto bushes, interspersed with a few pine trees. The landscape was dotted with small wood-frame cabins and rotting wooden docks that reached out into the brackish bay water. The town of Cedar Key became well known for the cedar pencils that used to be made there. I really like it there. With the exception of a couple of motels and a few modern brick houses, Cedar Key exists in a time warp. I took out my mountain bike and explored most of the old roads that traverse the island. I worked up a healthy appetite and a burning thirst, so I found a tavern on the wharf and satisfied my cravings with a dozen oysters and an ice-cold bud. The Gulf water was considerably warmer here, so I went for a swim, and then I stretched out on a shaded picnic table for an afternoon snooze. Did I happen to mention that life was good? I pointed Zelda south again and passed through many familiar places. Crystal River, Homosassa Springs, and Crumacoochee. We simply called it Crooms when we were teenagers, and that's where the dirt bikers could be found on the weekends. My brother Greg, a friend named Steve, and I lived for Saturdays when we loaded up the dirt bikes and headed for Crooms. We spent many a day whistling through the pine trees and across the whoop-de-doos at full throttle. Half the time our front wheels were freewheeling in the midair, and the rear knobbies skimmed across the bumps, spewing dust and dirt in the faces of whoever followed. We were living large. I wandered on south through Brooksville and Dade City. I had traversed these roads 1,000 times with my dad when he was out repossessing cars. Among other law enforcement-related jobs, Dad was a repo man, and my brother and I jumped at every chance to drive home a hot car. Dad repoed lots of muscle cars in the 70s. We got to drive Mustangs, Malibus, GTOs, Grand Ams, and every other kind of car on the road. Once I even got to drive a Dodge Daytona Superbird. It was an orange with a duckbill nose and a large spoiler mounted on the rear. It was quite possibly the ugliest car to ever roll out of Detroit. Most of the cars, however, were mundane sedans, but in the hands of a 16-year-old, anything with wheels constituted a man and his machine. Dad always took us along because even in the dark, Greg and I could spot any make and model of a car from a mile away. Mustangs had narrow headlights, and if it was a GT or a Shelby, there would be yellow running lights mounted in the grille. Plymouths had 4 headlights stacked high and wide, and most full-size Pontiacs had 4 headlights that were low and wide. We always got our man, or car, that is. The last time I'd driven into Lakeland, Florida, orange groves, pastures, and swamps still bordered Highway 98. Only a handful of fruit stands and small farmhouses had dotted the roadside. Today, shopping malls have picked the orange groves bare, car lots now graze the pastures, and subdivisions were oozing out of the swamps. I passed Sokomaloop Road. We lived out there next to the swamps when I was a kid. A sandy dirt path led down through the trees to our house. The house itself was an old L-shaped clapboard frame house with a steeped pitch tin roof. There was a row of palm trees in the front and a huge avocado tree loomed over the back. Sometimes the avocados would break loose in the middle of the night and bounce off the tin roof. That thunderous sound would scare the bejeebies out of any 5-year-old. I hated avocados when I was a kid, and they were free for the taking. Now I love them and they're $2 a pound. On one side of the house was an orange grove, and the other side was the swamp. Swamp was complete with alligators and water moccasins. A trail led down through the swamp to our neighbor's house, and that's where my childhood sweetheart lived. She was an older woman, though, 4 days older. I spent a good many afternoons walking down that path to visit Sara Lee. I kept a watchful eye in the murky black waters, because it wasn't that rare to spot a big old gator's eyes peeking out, or to see a water moccasin lounging in a tree. Sometimes they would crawl out on the road to sun themselves, and that was the days I chose not to visit my one true love. If I stayed too late, I'd have to come home in the dark. When that happened, I closed my eyes and ran like hell down that dirt road, because I didn't really want to see the gator that was going to have my young hide for dinner. Some days I still feel like I'm running through that swamp with my eyes closed. Oh, the price of romance. As a matter of factoid, they used to call me Gator. I didn't acquire that name until years later when I moved to Colorado and started driving trucks. One day a bunch of drivers were sitting around telling lies about their brave and cunning feats in the great outdoors. It came my turn to lie, which I had to do, because I had never killed anything meaner than a 6-pack of Bud. So I told them about the time I led the Sokomaloop Gator wrestling team to the Gator National Championships. It was the final go-round, and I was up. I came out of that chute and dove on top of that big old gator just like a steer wrestler. I flipped him on his back and pulled a live water moccasin from my belt and used it as a picking string, and I had him tied in 6.75 seconds. I must have spun a pretty good yarn, because those old truckers' eyes got as big as the hubcaps on a 56 Buick. So they started calling me Gator, and the name stuck. In 1962, we moved from the country to the proverbial wrong side of town. I drove past the church we attended, where I was reassured every Sunday morning that my young heart was evil, and my eternal soul was surely going to burn in hell. I had the urge to lock the doors when I drove through our old neighborhood. Most of the buildings had been torn down or boarded up, and plenty of unsavory characters were milling around on the street corners. Lakeland has some beautiful neighborhoods, although we never lived in any of them. My brother, Robin, on the other hand, finally did migrate to the proper side of town. He and his wife, Joan, live only a stone's throw away from the yacht club. When I turned Zelda onto their street, the first thing I saw was a big sign that said, "No trucks." I had no desire to rattle the neighbors' cages, so I snuck up the street as quiet as possible. To my relief, I didn't attract any unwanted attention, and no one called the SWAT team. As it turned out, several of the neighbors dropped by to admire Zelda, and more than one of them threatened to stow away in the back when I left for Alaska. Robin is my oldest brother, and he's a case study in survival. When he was 27 years old, he was diagnosed with cancer. The doctors believed that he had less than 6 months to live. That was over 20 years ago. Since then, he's survived a dozen surgeries and has so many scars that he looks like an alligator chewed him up and spit him out. One time, he was so sick, funeral arrangements had been made. But a few days later, Robin came out of surgery and was patrolling the halls of the hospital, wanting to know when he could go home and finish remodeling his house. Robin is a do-it-yourselfer and a power tool freak. He remodels his house more often than some people mow their yard. The paint doesn't dry on one wall before he's taking a sledgehammer and bashing down another one. Once he was tearing down a wall, but the chainsaw was taking too long, so he threatened to back up his 1947 Dodge Power Wagon and push it down. That's what you call a power tool, but that's also where Joan drew the line. Robin had volunteered to help me finish out Zelda's interior. Unfortunately, he's a perfectionist who insists on doing things his way. I, on the other hand, will agree to almost anything, as long as it's done my way, damn it. Of course, his perception of perfection isn't the same as mine. For a surefire recipe for some low-grade humor, put a couple of control freaks inside a black box, set the box under a scalding hot Florida sun, and arm each of them with an arsenal of power tools. Then add some humidity, let simmer, and see what cooks. Too bad Jerry Springer wasn't around to tape it. First, we disagreed on how smooth the floor should be. Robin strongly encouraged me to use a floor sander to spiff up the hardwood floor. His image of smooth resembled the surface of a meditation pond. My idea of smooth was more like the dance floor of a West Texas pool hall. He envisioned a mobile mansion, and I envisioned a super truck that I could haul a Harley and a mountain bike in. I wanted to traipse in and out with the mud and the blood and the beer and not give a damn what happened to the floor. However, there is an unspoken rule among brothers. He who has the tools rules. I caved into my brother's not-so-subtle suggestions and used a floor sander that had the equivalent of a fuel-injected small-block Chevy for a motor. When I dropped the whirling barrels of that bad boy onto the floor, it dug in like a rototiller. It tore into that hardwood like a buzzsaw into balsa wood. Now Zelda has a floor that any cowboy worth his chaps would be proud to scoot his boots across. Progress was slow, but Zelda began to take shape. We cut three tall rectangular holes for windows on each side, then a triangular hole for the passageway from the truck cab to the camper. Combine the shape of those holes with the large square hole in the rear for the roll-up door, and Zelda looked like one of those block puzzles that kids play with. What I had envisioned as taking only a few weeks and a couple $1,000s had taken 2 months and several $1,000s, and it still wasn't finished. As time wore on, my patience and resources wore down. What I dreamed would be a fun project turned into my worst nightmare. Like many do-it-yourselfers, I had severely underestimated the expense and overestimated the pleasure of my project. I began to realize why I often saw the remains of school buses and greyhounds rotting in backyards all across America. They were the remnants of some do-it-yourselfer like myself who tried to convert a bus into a motorhome. The project degraded from divine inspiration to the desperate search for someone to blame. I was beginning to wish I'd just got one of them Winnebagos. I started most days with a parts run. RV parts are expensive, and for some mysterious reason, most of them are not compatible with auto parts or regular home appliances. I made at least 2,365 search and destroy missions looking for components that were compatible, only to get back to work and discover that this part wouldn't fit that part, and neither part fit the others. The first 789 trips were to pick up the parts I thought I needed, and the next 1,576 trips were to exchange those parts for something that might work. On the days that Robin went to work, I had no transportation other than Zelda and the Harley. I took the Harley when I was chasing small parts like brass fittings, nails, or glue. But when it came to larger items like refrigerators, stoves, and windows, I had to pack all the tools and secure anything that wasn't nailed down and drive Zelda. It was sort of like building a house, except I had to stop every other day and move the house to a new lot. Of course, the folks at the home improvement centers were getting a huge kick out of this. One day I was standing in the checkout line with an odd-looking array of plumbing fixtures that resembled a prop from Back to the Future. "What the heck is that?" the girl at the counter asked. I held up my piece of handiwork. This is a matter processor. It converts..." She looked at my contraption with a grimace. "Not that," she said. "I was talking about that thing." She pointed an accusing finger towards Zelda. "What the heck is that?" "Well, it's a Peterbilt up front and sort of like a Winnebago in the back. I guess that makes it a Peterbago." I got tired of dismantling projects every other day in order to drive Zelda, so I started hauling larger items on the Harley. One day I hauled a roll of upholstery material. I draped the roll of material across my lap and let the ends hang to the ground. When I got up to about 45 miles per hour, the wind picked up the ends and they started flapping up and down like wings. I looked like an iron butterfly. The day I installed the upholstery material on the ceiling was unbearably hot. There was a heat index of 105 degrees. I confess I don't know exactly what a heat index is. I know what a chill factor is, but a heat index sounds like something a politician might use to hurl accusations at his opponent. "During my opponent's administration," the politician would say with self-righteous indignation, "the heat index rose above 100 for over 30 days in May. Something's got to be done." Well, I agree with that. I was sweating like a big dog while trying to glue the material to the ceiling. When I troweled the glue above my head, the gooey substance refused to stick and most of it dripped back onto the drop cloth or into my eyes, nose, or my mouth. It didn't taste near as good as the paste I ate when I was a kid. When I draped a large piece of the upholstery material over my head and tried to position it on the ceiling, I couldn't tell where I was and couldn't see what I was doing. I kept getting tangled up in the drop cloth that was now sticking to my tennis shoes. The temperature, or rather the heat index, under the heavy material had to be at least 140 degrees, and there was enough sweat pouring off my brow to float the Titanic. I tried to wipe the sweat from my eyes under the sleeve of my t-shirt, but only managed to glue my eyelid to my sleeve. I danced around and cussed, and I'm sure the muffled incantation sounded like I was speaking in tongues. I looked like I was experimenting with a portable sweat lodge. After I got the windows, refrigerator, stove, oak cabinets, and upholstery installed, it was time for the important stuff, the stereo. In the good old days, putting a stereo in your ride meant going down to Monkey Ward's and picking up the only 8-track stereo they had in stock. Then you hustled home, jerry-rigged a bracket under the dash, and strung some wires to a pair of 6x9 speakers that were stuffed into homemade wooden boxes. Voila, your ride had tunes. But nowadays, it's a different story. Today, if you want a stereo, you go to an electronic superstore. I walked in wearing a John Deere t-shirt, cut-off jeans, and worn-out tennis shoes. The sales clerks were making a career out of ignoring me. After the first half hour, I finally made contact with someone. "Excuse me, if you're a sales clerk, I'd like to buy a radio." "I'm the senior vice president of marketing," she said. "But I'm sure that Mr. Toonhead, our senior account executive and sound engineer, would be glad to demonstrate his product line." Whoop-dee-damn-do, I thought. Everybody has a title these days, except truck drivers. This guy sounded important, so I tucked in my t-shirt and prepared to introduce myself. "Nice to meet you, Mr. Toonhead. My name is Gary Strait, senior vice president of product relocation and steering engineer, and I'd like to buy a damn radio." "Hey, dude, we don't sell radios. We sell sound systems." "Whatever." Mr. Toonhead was a pimply-faced kid with a shaved head and a goatee, wearing breeches that hung down around his knees. As it turned out, I was better dressed. He waddled into a room that looked like mission control at NASA. My eyes adjusted to the darkness, and I scanned the price tags that hung from the ominous-looking panels of flashing lights and dials. Most of the components cost more than my first three cars put together. Hey, dude, want to test drive the new KQ450XL nuclear-powered turbo ear piercer? This mother's got more horsepower than the space shuttle. It's on sale for $1,999, and if you buy today, we can throw in $99.95 installation for free. Whew. Lose a handful of those nines, and you got a deal, mister. No way, dude. I got two other dudes looking at it. I looked around and didn't see anyone standing in line to buy the KQ450XL whatever. Nah, I ain't got a license for that thing, I said. I'm not old enough, or I'm too old, or whatever. I need something a little more modest, say something under $200. He stepped back and glared. Hey, dude, $200 won't even score you the speakers. What planet are you from? I self-consciously ran my head over my head and wondered if my antennas and pointed ears were showing again, while he scanned the walls looking for something a little more my speed. I guess there's this thing, dude, he said. It's $199.95. You reckon I could stick a tape in? Sure, dude. He rummaged through a box of tapes. We got some jamming tunes, Garbage, Smashing Pumpkins. I rolled back on my heels, pulled the toothpick from my mouth, and said, got any Merle? Who? He dug around in a box and pulled out a tape, and it dangled it from his forefinger and thumb. I got this chick with the belly button thing going on. Shania Twain? That's Twain, I said. I listened to Shania singing about how I could win her love with a 65-cylinder racy little run around town. I had no idea what a 65-cylinder racy little run around town was, but she sounded good singing about it. I'll take it, I said. Hey, dude, we can install it for $125. I thought installation was $99.95. Well, that was before the price increase. No, thanks. I'm the do-it-yourselfer type. I paid for the stereo with my overworked charge card and left. After a couple more search-and-destroy missions, I rounded up an amplifier, some crossovers, and 100 foot of used wire. I combined that with two tweeters, two 15-inch woofers, and two horns that I scavenged out of an old home stereo console. And voila, I had some jamming tunes that would happen with the baddest or something like that. I've never been one to use credit cards very much. I'm a cash and carry kind of guy. But I'd already violated every self-imposed rule concerning credit. In the past, I only used credit cards as tools for emergencies, but now I was using it for everything. First, it was the insulation and paneling, then the solid oak cabinets, then the stainless steel sink and countertops, and then the refrigerator and the stove. It all happened so fast. I had become a credit card junkie. I had no intention of spending so much on my project, but I did. Someone once told me that the best way to arrive at an accurate estimate of time and materials on any given project was to double the cost of materials and triple the amount of time. I found this not to be true, but I have discovered the correct formula. First, add the cost of all known materials, then multiply that figure by 41, then divide by the square root of the national debt, and add back in the exact sum of your life savings. And you might as well kiss your inheritance from your rich Aunt Martha goodbye and throw that in to cover the cost overruns. Second, add up how many hours it'd take a true handyman like Tim the Tool Man to do the job, and then factor in another 73% for error. Then take that amount and multiply it by the number of days in the month and divide by your dog's age. If you don't have a dog, get one, because you'll be so damned irritable by the time you finish your project that no other living creature will have anything to do with you. I now feel I am qualified to bid government jobs. I was nearing the end of my second month in Florida, and Zelda still wasn't finished. I didn't have the time, money, or patience to install a bathroom, so I decided to do without one, which was no big deal. I had spent the better part of 20 years living in trucks with no bathrooms. I could survive one more summer. Since all of my cash was gone and my credit cards were maxed out, I decided I had to sell some photography equipment. I sold $3,000 worth of studio lighting equipment for $1,200 and earmarked the first $200 of that for putting the finishing touches on Zelda. When that was gone, I was gone, come hell or hurricane. That $200 went up in smoke faster than fireworks on the 4th of July, and I still wasn't finished. I ended up taking some brass fittings I hadn't used back to the hardware store. I couldn't find the receipt, so I had to sweet-talk the clerk into bartering with me. I managed to trade some brass fittings for a couple of light fixtures. Once the lights were installed, Zelda the Pete was finally complete.
I hope you've enjoyed part one of Straight from the Road. Look for part two at Truck Stops Nationwide. Or order a copy by sending a check or money order for $5 to High Plains Publishing, 712 Winchester Drive, Fort Collins, Colorado, 80526.